Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the podcast. Today we have a really exciting episode because we have Jenna Nelson on. Jenna is a nutritional therapist, and honestly, in this episode, I learned so much. I learned about the fact that the nutrients in vegetables nowadays are so much less than they were 10 years ago. And this is due to the soil being kind of overfarmed. I do a terrible job at explaining it. I'm sure Jenna will do a better job, but that is just one of the things I've learned. I've learned how your genetics can interact differently with the food that you eat and what to do to tailor your diet to your genetics. Honestly, this was a super interesting conversation about nutrition and about how you can better your nutrition. But without further ado, let's get into this episode of the Into the Mind podcast. Context of everything is key. And I think when you're watching like a 12-second video on TikTok, you can't get context.
Yeah.
Have you seen like a impact or an influence with social media in terms of what people are wanting to do with their diet?
Yeah, it's huge. As soon as you go on Instagram, I'm not on TikTok. I refuse to download the app.
Brain rots.
So I honestly my brain would leak out the side of my head. But on Instagram, and then like we were talking about the algorithm, it's just going to enforce what you're looking at if you're engaging in it. But yeah, and the whole conversation just now around menopause, that is a huge, there's a phrase for it, menowashing, because it's an industry in and of itself, because women are confused.
So what exactly is menowashing?
Menowashing is like where there's products or product placement or advice, articles, blogs, content that's designed to educate the person or the individual.
Okay.
But it's contradictory. So the person's already confused. They're doing their own research and then they find an opposing opinion and then they're even more confused. So they'll be more likely drawn to the product that's making claims. So
right.
The product that's claiming, we can remove your hot flushes, we can help you sleep better, we'll help you lose weight. That's where the ASA should go after that individual or that company, because they're making false claims.
Can they go after the company if it's based out of the UK? Like, is there legalities around it?
I know the ASA is based it's a UK organisation. So for me as a practitioner, I have to be really, really careful what I say. I cannot make health claims. I can't say that product A results in the resolution of symptom B. I have to be really belt and braces, and my health claims they're all authorised, and the ASA have a list of what those authorised health claims are. So if you look at a supplement that's got authorised health claims, you'll see it's very clear language, and it'll be the same health claim across a lot of supplements.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a minefield.
What are the thoughts on supplements? Because I've seen this, and we were talking about Stephen Bartlett earlier, and Huel is a company, and a lot of people supplementing on TikTok, you know, whether it's vitamin D or, yeah. I suppose in Scotland, we probably do need vitamin D. But what are your thoughts on health supplements or dietary health supplements?
Okay, it comes back to context. So I work one-to-one with clients, so I will know their entire health history, because that's the foundation of how I work with a client, is I take a health inventory at the start. So I'll know what medication they're on, I'll know what health conditions they have, I'll know if they're under any stress, what kind of job they do they sleep well. So this is the context that builds the holistic picture of that person. So I use supplements therapeutically.
Okay.
So what that means is vitamin D is a different one. So we could probably start with that. So vitamin D, everyone needs to be supplementing vitamin D,
especially
if you're in Scotland, in the Northern Hemisphere, from October through to end of March, you need to be supplementing, because the sun is not high enough in the sky to have the correct angle to hit your skin to make vitamin D. So you need to supplement. And even if you've had a good summer where you've been exposed to the sun, vitamin D has a half-life. So you might have topped it up during the summer, but it's going to run out. So you need to top it up supplementally and through your diet. So I use supplements therapeutically. So that's an example of a therapeutic intervention. And I'll do it with other nutrients. So we can get into the genetic testing. So that's where we can fine tune genes. We can either dial them up or dial them down using what we call cofactors, which are nutrients that are found in supplements. And we're doing very specific fine-tuning. So we either want to speed up a gene or we want to slow it down. But the supplements that you find on the shelf, so in your supermarket, they're broad spectrum supplements, and the doses tend to be lower that are safe enough that anybody who's on medication of any sort could, depending on what the medication is, they could take it alongside that that medication. Therapeutic supplements will have higher doses, so we're using them for a very targeted, specific approach.
Okay.
So again, it's context. The ones on the shelf will have bulkers, fillers, toxins, chemicals, and it's really down to the consumer to look at the back of the box and educate themselves on what are they actually taking and why are they taking it. I see a lot of people who come to me with like carrier bags full of supplements and they don't know why they're taking them.
Yeah,
they've just seen an advert or they've heard that vitamin C is good for the immune system, so they're basically rattling with, you know, supplements. So what I will do is look at what they're taking and then really strip that back. But can we do it with diet first? Can we take a food first approach and then top up what we need to with supplements?
That's a good point. So you're basically saying that you should maybe get the diet correct.
Absolutely. Food first.
Prior to the... Yeah. Right. Okay. And I suppose the reason for that is that if you get the diet correct, the rest will follow, right?
It should do. Yeah.
Okay.
But there's arguments on that too, because our soil is far more depleted than it was before. So the nutrient status of food that's grown in the ground or on a tree, it's not as high. I mean, there's studies that show that the amount of nutrients in a carrot is not what it used to be decades ago.
Wow, why is that? Just because of genetics?
We're over farming our soil. So every time we farm, we deplete the soil.
Of its nutrients.
Yeah. And we need those nutrients in the soil to help the vegetables grow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we don't know that as consumers, right? We're unaware of that. So, yeah.
So yeah. Even if we were to eat the nutrient, like let's say I was to eat a piece of broccoli, it would not have, typically speaking, the same nutritional sort of benefit as a piece of broccoli 10 years ago.
Yeah. So there's a sort of line of thought about eating how our grandparents used to eat, but their food was more nutritious. So the food that they were growing 50, 60 years ago was grown in soil that wasn't over-farmed.
Okay.
Is it something like in the States, of something like 2 decades or maybe not even that left of viable soil
really
left to farm, because they've so intensively farmed that the soil is completely devoid of any nutrients? That's frightening.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's terrifying.
And as civilians and individuals, we don't know that.
And so even with all that, this farmland in the UK, because I mean, Scotland's a lot of it's different.
Yeah. So our meat, for example, this is something I love about Scotland. Our meat is grass fed. So it's raised on grass, which is what you want. Whereas if you eat meat in the States that's full of antibiotics, it's raised on different grains and things to fatten the cattle up. Whereas our cattle is raised on grass, and you can tell that. You can tell the difference in the quality of our meat.
Tender. Yeah. You can taste it more.
You get it in Aldi. Aldi steaks are grass-fed steaks, and they're inexpensive. Big advocate for Aldi. Aldi steaks.
Cheap and cheerful.
Exactly. But once you educate yourself and you know what you're looking for, you can go and find it.
So do you think there's as well as the nutritional value of, like, let's say a broccoli 10 years ago was better than it is today, would you say that some of the meats that we're eating, especially like chicken, because they're battery farmed?
I wouldn't touch it.
Yeah, so you just wouldn't go near it?
Organic only if it's chicken. Yeah.
And that's because, it's not because of the price, I suppose. That's because of exactly what you know is in it in terms of the vitamins.
And how they clean it as well. So they use chemicals like chlorine. So they'll chlorine wash it. Anyone that's worked in the food industry knows this.
Well, that Lynn was working.
Lynn mentioned this. So Marks and Spencer's, just to name drop, and also maybe definitely your local butcher will have access to animals that have been reared ethically, and they're not battery hens, they've not been shoved in a tiny little space, they've been free roaming, and you can tell in the quality of the meat. I won't buy supermarket chicken because it's just nasty. And then once you know how it's been reared and then how it's been looked after, and a lot of our meat that's coming in is not UK meat either, that's the other part to this. So it's the standards around the welfare of that animal are significantly lower than UK standards. Organic only when it comes to chicken,
yeah,
and ideally red meat as well if you can afford it.
Do you think the red meat is bad? Like, I always hear this stigma, especially when I go to the doctors and it's like, don't eat too much red meat. Mm. It can cause cancers. Mm. would you disagree, or what would your kind of viewpoint
personally,
that be?
Personally, I don't restrict red meat.
Okay.
If you have good quality grass-reared meat, the nutrient status is what you need it to be. It's not full of chemicals. There's arguments to say, and this is a contentious topic, it's not the red meat that's causing the cancer.
Okay. It's the pesticides, the stuff that's sprayed on it, or maybe not pesticides.
It's likely the nutrient devoid food that you're eating with it, if that makes sense.
Okay.
So if you're eating highly processed foods that maybe contain red meat, or you're eating burgers and whatever from fast food joints, it's the chemicals around the fast food part of it that's not helpful. That's raising inflammation in your body. Mm. Yeah, there's arguments on both sides, and this is back to context again. It's what is right for that individual. Some people don't do well on lots of red meat, and it just depends on what their constitution is. Some people prefer fish or white meat.
Yeah.
But from a nutrient perspective, I always try and encourage, can you at least have some red meat in your diet? And it's difficult because I'm flying in the face of what your doctor's saying,
yeah.
Which is, yeah, mostly people will always default to what their doctor has said.
But the doctor can't be good. I've said this in another podcast. Doctors are a lot of the time deemed as God.
Yeah.
I have friends that are doctors and they're absolutely fucking mental. So like they can't always be put on a pedestal. You need to think of your own, like bring your logical brain into it. Mm-hmm. Caveman hunter-gatherers would eat red meat.
Yes.
So how could that red meat then turn bad for you? Well, maybe what you're saying is correct.
You're eating processed red meat.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of doctors they're not trained in nutrition. If they are open-minded, they'll have done advanced training in nutrition or lifestyle medicine, or they'll have specialized in that area. But their training does not take them into macronutrient understanding, nutritional status, none of that. So how can they have a meaningful conversation with a patient? They can give diet and lifestyle advice, but it's very generic and it's very basic.
Yeah, it's like a blanket almost.
Yeah, it's
for
blanket
everyone.
Generic advice, whereas if you go to a nutritionist or a nutritional therapist, it's specific to that person, it's unique. And this is the danger. If you come back to social media, anything that you read or hear is generic because it has to be, because you're talking to an audience, whereas if you're working one-on-one, you're homing in on what is correct for that individual, what is unique to them, and that's specialized. And that's not for everyone. Some people are not ready for that kind of specialist intervention. They want the general calories in, calories out model.
Yeah.
But there's more to it than that.
100%. But there's also, yeah, I suppose social media rewards a very broad topic, right? There was a guy, do you know James Smith?
No.
The PT?
Oh, yes, I do. Sorry, yes.
English guy.
Yes.
Brilliant. Yeah. I personally think he brings it back to sense. He talks sense and he just cuts through all the bullshit.
He's not a bullshitter, is he? He's just very black and white.
Exactly. Yeah. And he was talking about a guy that was saying, you know, if you put lemon in your water, you'll start to lose weight because this has this in it, and et cetera, et cetera. And James Smith was like, do you really think that putting a squirt of lemon or 3 drops of lemon in your water every morning is going to do fucking anything for your diet? He was like, don't be so stupid and don't fall for these, like, these people that don't actually know what they're talking about. They're trying to be rewarded by the algorithm.
So what they've done is, so there's a little bit of truth in that, but again, the context is massively missing. Mm. So the lemon water will stimulate the liver, and the liver will then help your digestion to produce more stomach acid. So some people do apple cider vinegar as well, and there's a big weight loss thing around that. But the context is missing, because what you're actually doing is helping your digestion to break down the food. But you can't do that if you're then stuffing your face with burgers, cakes and cookies. Like, are you mad?
You
know, and that's where you need a holistic approach. It's not just one thing. So you can't just kid yourself into thinking, well, take this supplement and that will fix everything. You've got to look at all areas of your life. If you're staying up late and binge eating before you go to sleep,
boozing,
and then you're drinking, but then you think if you take a supplement that will correct it, then you're kind of lying to yourself. That's not going to get you where you want to go.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you would say that the kind of the bottom line of it is, you know, you need to strip everything else back and look at your diet first, essentially. Mm-hmm. But you are right. Like if you're, I feel like people want a quick fix.
They do. They want always a silver bullet.
Exactly. They want a silver bullet. They want instant abs, or they want like, you know, how can I get built without training? Or like, unfortunately, these things take time and they take effort and they're hard.
You say you come to that conclusion in your 40s. It's taken 4 decades to get to where you are. Do you really think if you take a supplement, you're suddenly going to reveal your abs?
Yeah.
You've got to unwind 3 or 4 decades of what you've done to yourself prior to that. And that takes some time. And you really have to be honest with yourself about how, and every person's different as well. And then if you throw chronic stress in the mix, so if you've got a stressful job or a stressful home life, no matter what you do with your diet and lifestyle, that stress will always win. It will, evolutionary, will always outstrip everything else that you're doing. Because those stress hormones are working against, down your digestion. It's closing down parts of your brain that you need for cognition and executive function. It's affecting your sleep. It then might make you have certain coping mechanisms, so you maybe drink more caffeine or you drink more alcohol, and then you're just, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. So it really is that, what, like what you said is a nice phrase, stripping it right back to, hang on, okay, what time do I actually go to bed? Am I going to bed at a time that's right for me? Do I eat breakfast? Is eating breakfast right for me? And it's individuating it for that person. Now, if you put that person out there and they're consuming content that's misleading, it's, the context is missing. So they don't actually know what is right for them.
Yeah.
So they're trying to do it piecemeal. So I'll see people will come to me and they've tried different things and they're looking for that one thing. And then it's a conversation about, actually, it's not just one thing. It's lots of things done consistently.
Yeah.
And through that, you're building a foundation that's immovable, it's solid. So no matter how much your stress ramps up or you go through a period of time where you're maybe not sleeping, you've got this solid foundation that you'll always come back to.
Yeah.
And it's not based on calorie count and it's not based on restriction. It's based on simple things done consistently. I always talk about that 1% better. So most people, they just want to feel 1% better, sorry, 10%.
Yeah.
10% better than, and a lot of people don't know how good feels because they've never felt it. So yeah, context, we'll keep coming back to that. It's the thing that's massively missing in that industry.
It's key. And you said something interesting there about stress. And this is something that I've literally not even looked at my notes yet, but there was something that I wrote down that I wanted to ask you. Burnout and stress. I think that like, you are right in the way it's like a self-fulfilling cycle, right? Because let's say I was out in London this weekend, so it was my birthday. Went out in London and I had a rough weekend and I came back and I thought I'm gonna get a pizza because I feel shit.
Yes.
And then I woke up in the morning and think, I feel shit, I'm gonna get a bacon roll. Yeah. And then I have the bacon roll and I go into work and I can't be bothered making lunch. Yeah. I'm gonna go out for a Greggs. And then you just keep spiraling.
Keep going,
What impact would diet have on burnout and stress, especially when you have like a stressful job?
Yeah. So I've been there. So that part of your brain when you're stressed shuts down. So you cannot make, as much as you want to, and you'll tell yourself, you cannot make considered choices. So physiologically, also what's happening is your insulin is shot through the roof because your cortisol is shot through the roof. So when your cortisol raises, it pushes your insulin up, and that's where your cravings will come in. So your insulin's high, your cortisol's high, your adrenaline's pumping through your body. You're effectively in fight or flight. So you're not making considered good choices for what is good for you. Your sleep's probably knackered as well because your circadian rhythm is completely shot and you're in survival mode. You're not making good choices in that moment. And this is something I'm really passionate about talking to clients about, because this is something my industry actually perpetuates and it frustrates me. We'll write a protocol for a client and we'll say something like, something flippant like, manage your stress. Now, if you've ever been in chronic stress, someone telling you to manage your stress levels is the last thing that you want to hear, because you're like, well, I would if I could, because it's a physiological thing that's happening that you really don't have any control over. It's just freewheeling. But there are things you can do, and it's knowing what those things are and also giving yourself grace. that actually in this moment I am in survival mode. I might just be reaching for refined carbs because that's what my body just needs, instant energy. And you can do that for a short period of time. But if that becomes a prolonged coping strategy, that's where the problems come in.
And arise.
Yeah. Because that then becomes normal. You think that that's normal.
All right, everybody, let's just take a quick break for a second to talk about the sponsors of the Into the Mind podcast. Chisholm Hunter are the sponsors of the podcast, and Chisholm Hunter are a luxury family-owned retailer. They specialize in luxury watches and also luxury diamonds. And to top that off, they're actually world-renowned for their luxury diamonds. If you're looking for something for yourself or a loved one, if you like watches like Tudor, Tag Heuer, Omega, Vacheron Constantin, Blancpain, and many, many more, and are looking for a safe, authorized dealer, then Chisholm Hunter are the luxury retailer for you. So if you're looking for something for yourself or a loved one, head to chisholmhunter.co.uk. That's chisholmhunter.co.uk. And while you're there, make sure you use the discount code CHSUB, that is CHSUB, for an exclusive 10% off selected lines. That's CHSUB at chisholmhunter.co.uk, chisholmhunter.co.uk. And on that note, let's get back to talking to Jenna. See, if someone was to come to you and said, listen, I'm in that cycle of just fast food and drinking, and then I feel bad, so I have six coffees, and then all the, you know, it happens to all of us, I think, at least at one point in our lives. What would be your kind of quick advice if you were to give a quick fix for helping the diet to help stress and burnout?
Blood sugar levels. So anyone that's ever worked with me will know that I just hammer this home for everybody, even if they're stressed or not. If you can stabilize your blood sugar by prioritizing protein, so put protein in the morning. So a lot of people will do their Cocoa Pops or their whatever, Shreddies, which is highly sugary. It's going to spike your insulin even more. So if you've already got a high insulin level, you're just throwing more lighter fluid on a raging fire. So put protein in. So you're kind of blunting it off.
The eggs or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no rules. We sometimes have leftovers. So if you've got leftover curry or chili... I delay breakfast a little bit because I do sort of time-restricted eating. So my lunch kind of becomes brunch, so about 11 or 12 o'clock. So we'll do leftovers, so maybe a leftover chili or curry. So you've got that hit of protein in the morning or a protein drink, and then that stabilizes your insulin. So you're not going to get that crazy peak, because on the other side of that peak is a crash. But you crash way lower than where you started out, and that's the point at which you're looking for the coffee...
Yeah.
The sugary drinks, the cakes,
quick hits.
Something quick, because your blood sugar is so inconsistent. But if you can help to blunt it out, so protein at every meal helps to stabilize that. That will take your foot off the adrenaline pedal, the internal adrenaline and internal stress hormones. It starts to take the pressure off. Then once you're balanced, you can then make more conscious choices. So it's a tip, if you're hungover, you're going to want to, physiologically, you're going to reach for the carbs because your insulin's all over the shop. But if you can kind of teach yourself, right, I want the carbs, but can I have something that's protein dense first?
Yeah.
And then if I still want the carbs, then I'll have them. Protein at every meal, especially breakfast, if you can do it, if you can stomach breakfast.
And you don't think the protein's like, because I've heard, again, different people talking, it's probably on social media, I've probably been influenced by social media, but people are saying, you know, you shouldn't have protein all the time because too much protein can lead to certain types of cancer and too much protein.
It's context, you know, that's a blanket statement to a population. The clients that I see, when I look at their food diary, they're under eating, definitely under eating protein. They're surviving on refined carbohydrates.
Sugars.
Yeah, so there's probably some protein around dinner time. Maybe if they have a chicken fillet or some fish, that's the only time in the day that they've had any protein. Where was it at breakfast? Where was it at lunch? And we need the amino acids. We can get on to talking about dopamine as a neurotransmitter. We make that from the amino acids that we get from protein.
Well, that's interesting. Wait, in order to have dopamine, you need amino acids. Yeah. In order to create amino acids, you need protein.
You need to have it in your diet.
Right.
We don't make it. We need to. So these amino acids are what we call essential. So we have to get them from our diet. We don't make them.
Okay.
So we have to get them from outside of us. So we need, dopamine, for example, you need tyrosine, which is the amino acid. And then that then creates something called L-DOPA, and then it's converted into dopamine. But if you don't have that in your diet, you're kind of setting yourself up for a fail straight from the outset.
And you'll feel worse.
Well, yeah, because you're undernourished. You're not getting the micronutrients or the macronutrients that you need to actually run your body.
Is that why people hunt for like alcohol? Because it releases it synthetically rather than...
Possibly, yeah.
Or drugs even.
Yeah, because they're getting a dopamine dump from that. But the more you do that, the more you need. It's because you're going to drain that tank of dopamine, and you're just going to... That hit needs to get higher and higher and higher, and it's a kind of zero-sum game because it's so detrimental. That's addiction, which is an entirely different conversation.
But can the addiction be prevented? I suppose.
Do
you know what I mean? I've got friends that I love to pieces, but their diets are pish and they drink all the time.
You can see a pattern, can't you?
And occasionally do drugs. And they occasionally then turns into doing drugs most weekends. And then most weekends spills into, and they're vaping all the time. Yeah. They're smoking all the time. Like if they sorted their diet and had those amino acids created by the protein that then gave them dopamine, could they be more fulfilled without those things?
Ideally, I'm an idealist, so in an ideal world, yes. But if you've got an addictive personality, you don't want to do that because that's not a quick win. You're not sitting thinking, oh, has my diet got all the correct constituents that I need? Because you don't likely know in that moment that what you're hunting is dopamine. You don't know that until you work with someone who points it out, but it's unlikely that they will seek that out. On paper, you probably could say, yes, you could see on the pathway, yes, if you corrected
XYZ,
that, then possibly. But there's so many other factors involved that it's not, addiction is a multifaceted conversation. It's not really about the substance. There's trauma in there, likely. Yeah. There's a backstory. There's lack of nutrients.
Lack of education as well.
Yeah, there's a genetic component. There's family history. So much. And that individual is probably not, they're switched off to that. They're just doing what they're doing because it makes them feel good. Those are not the clients that are coming to me. The types of clients that are coming to me are ones that are saying, like, they've maybe had, say, for example, an ADHD diagnosis, or they think the ADHD might be something that's relevant for them, or they recognize that they're hunting dopamine. They're doing things that they know they feel good in the moment, but in the long run, they kind of feel icky after it. So we can look at their pathways. We can see, well, genetically, are you someone that at the start of that pathway, is your diet optimal? And then down that pathway, have you got the cofactors that you need in your diet to help with the conversion? Are your receptors sensitive enough that even if you are making dopamine, are they listening? So do we need to dial that up a little bit? And then are you someone that favors adrenaline? Because dopamine becomes adrenaline. So if you are someone that's constantly pushing the adrenaline pedal, that dopamine is going to get diverted to adrenaline. And then you're stuck on that hamster wheel of fight or flight. And then at the other end is, are you someone that detoxes it too quickly? So even if you're making it, your body's getting rid of it too quickly because it's not hanging around long enough for you to feel the benefit of the dopamine. It's such a complex area and it's not one thing.
Yeah, and I feel like, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong here because it might be quite a blanket statement.
Go for it.
But I do this all the time, so it's fine. But would you say that society is catering for the addictive food personality?
Yes.
would you say that?
I don't have the facts to hand, but I know there are groups of people within industry, so like the food industry, for example, where their job is to make that food as addictive as possible. So they'll sort of do taste tests. So they'll dial up the salt and the sugar and the fat to make it more palatable. And once you're on that, it tastes good, right? Like fast food tastes good and it hits the spot. And so it becomes addictive and you're stuck on that. And it's not, speaking from personal experience, it's not until you clean your diet up and you come off of that and then you have it, you realize just how crap it tastes and how bad you feel when you do it regularly. So yeah, I think it's all geared towards tapping into that kind of instant gratification.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But in the long run, it's creating massive health problems for people.
And I think that, well, I think you said there you didn't have evidence, but I suppose if you go through, like, we live in Glasgow or Scotland, right? Mm. If you go through Buchanan Street, there's your evidence.
Oh, yeah.
You've got Greggs, Subway, Domino's. Like, it's all quick, fast. Like, yeah. there's nowhere in town. I think I've got, there's one salad place that I think is now shut down that I used to go, and everywhere else is fast food.
Yeah.
Like, there's, you can't get anything.
Yeah, and even if you're conscious of what carbohydrates you eat, so I talk about nature's carbs, sort of like fruit and veg, but if your carbohydrate within your diet is sort of pasta, bread, that kind of thing, that's what these places cater to. Mm. So like Greggs, for example, it's all carbs.
Yeah.
And it's all mass-produced, highly processed, ultra-processed, and it tastes good, and it's quick, and it's usually slightly cheaper than, well, that's arguably not true, but...
Well, not normally. Like, if you look in a supermarket now, if you were to buy bread and butter,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be a lot cheaper than salad and chicken.
Yeah.
Like the there's, it's skewed so that actually it's cheaper to get shit food.
Yeah.
Microwave pizzas, or, you know, oven pizzas, and chicken nuggets and things that have been ultra, ultra processed. It's a lot cheaper to do that. Is there anything that you think, like, I was thinking this the other day, is there anything that the government could do to try and intervene? Because obviously what's happening, like, from quite an obvious perspective, the businesses are coming in, the accountants are looking at it, they're saying, cut the costs here, 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 make it more addictive so that people come back. It's a bit like nicotine.
Yeah.
The nicotine industry, they bought vaping recently.
Yeah.
And their thing was like, well, make it pretty colors and make it pretty flavors, and then
it's
people will be more addicted.
Isn't it?
Exactly.
Just put people in,
Do you think that the government could do anything to, like, I suppose to try and tailor that so that people don't go down that line?
You're going to open a can of worms here that I'm not quite sure we should open. But I personally don't believe it's a governmental responsibility, and I don't feel that the knowledge and education is there. What we have currently is sort of public health guidelines around nutrition. So take vitamin D, for example. And I'll have to say this on the line, those recommendations are wildly under where we need them to be. So they're based on sort of war era, where it was to prevent rickets and the soldiers. So that's where our recommendations are still based.
For vitamin D?
Era. Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
And what we know about vitamin D is it's a hormone, so it's used in nearly every process in the body needs vitamin D, especially our immune system. That's not enough. It's wildly underestimated how much we actually need.
And there's no research that's gone into that since that time.
Well, so we're going to get into things that are contentious. So there's no money in research.
Right.
You have to, if you look at research, so back studies, anything to do with nutrition, look at who's paying for the study, which is, like I say, is a can of worms. So, yeah, it's just the consumer has to do their own research now, and they have to look at what information are they being spoon-fed and why are they being spoon-fed, and does it feel right in their body, and is that something they want to do?
But I think a lot of it, you're right, it's a sort of contentious topic.
Yeah.
But again, to me, a lot of it comes down to common sense.
It's not so common though, is it?
Well, exactly. But like, does this food taste sweet? Does it taste synthetic?
Here's the thing. So if you're hooked on junk food, your taste receptors will not know, you'll not discern the difference. So if you're not on junk food, so when you clean your diet up and you eat a whole food diet, when you then eat something that's synthetic, you can taste it. It's awful.
Yeah.
You can actually taste the chemicals in it. But if all you consume is chemical laden food, that's all your body knows. So your receptors kind of
burn,
they dumb down.
Yeah.
So if someone who's on a highly processed diet ate an apple, it wouldn't taste sweet to them because the sweetness is different.
Yeah.
They're used to a synthetic sweetness. Whereas when you clean your diet up and eat an apple, you're like, oh, holy shit, that's sweet.
Yeah.
And that's your taste receptors. But those receptors can change really quickly.
It's funny you say that. I remember I've got this really vivid memory. I was away in was traveling when I was like 19, 20. And I went to Colombia, Peru, kind of all around South America. And in South America, they pretty much don't have chocolate. Like they pretty much just don't have
it. Right?
Yeah. Or if they do have it, it's dark and it's a bit shit because it doesn't have
very
sugar
bitter.
In it. Yeah. So my taste buds were like, ugh, it's disgusting.
It's not chocolate. Yeah.
It's not chocolate. So I was out there for 2 months. And my diet was probably better than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. I then came back to the office and they had a box of celebrations. And I had one of the Mars bar celebrations. And I thought, oh my God, that is so disgustingly sweet. Mm-hmm. But then through the next 3 to 6 months, all of a sudden,
I'd adapted to it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that it's primarily in the UK that there's this, I suppose America is very bad, but America and the UK have the worst diets?
We do.
Do you think?
So they call it a SAD diet. So the standard diet, so the standard American diet is the SAD diet, which is highly processed. So it's ultra processed food. And that's what people are living on. There's no nutrients in it that their body needs. And you really just have to look at the state of their healthcare, the state of our healthcare in the UK. It's all lifestyle driven chronic diseases. And our healthcare system cannot cope with that. So I believe it's a civic responsibility to take care of your own health so that, you know, we talk about taking the pressure off the NHS. That would be the best way to do it, is to look after your own health. So you're then not relying on that system. That system's there for acute medical care. Like if you break your leg or you're in an accident, you want to be able to go to hospital or have an ambulance come and tend to you. But they're caught up in this bunch of people who have just, their health has spiraled, it's free fallen, and there's no mechanism in place to catch them because there's a lack of education. You've got lack of resources a lot of the time for people. There's a socioeconomic part to that. There's poverty. It's multifactorial. So when you say about the government, it's there's lots of layers to this.
And I think one layer specifically, and this is something that I was going to ask you about, because I have I've voiced my views on this before, I think on one of the other podcasts, but what are your views on like body positivity in terms of like, especially when it comes to overweight and obese? Because you've got plus size models, you've got overweight models. To me, a model is someone to aspire to, and you're never going to get there because these models are working out 6 hours a day, every day, and you don't have that time. But if you say Zac Efron's really hot, I want to get abs, I think that's a good goal. Like, I think that's a good thing to aim towards. Whereas if you're looking at an obese person and saying, oh, it's okay to be obese then, I think that's really dangerous.
It's a dangerous line, because on one hand, we're normalizing
that. Not normal. There's something that's not normal.
Yeah, so there's clearly a metabolic thing going on for that individual. But again, it comes back to context. Someone can carry more weight, and then you look at their markers, so their blood markers, cholesterol might be fine, insulin's fine. It depends on that. It depends on genetics. It depends on build. But I think there's a line, and I think we are straying over that line. But if I can speak from a woman's perspective, there's an immense pressure on women to be a certain size. But there's so many factors that go into weight gain. So when a woman reaches that point in her life where her hormones are vastly different, so estrogen is vastly declining, progesterone's left, the body's got a mechanism that will start to store fat, because that fat tissue releases a form of estrogen to help balance out that decline in estrogen. So she might be eating exactly how she's always in her life, exercised all the same way she's done through her 20s and 30s and 40s. And then suddenly she hits her 50s or late 40s. And all the things she was doing before are now not working, and she's rapidly putting weight on, and she can't understand why. So societally, she's then going out into the world and she's feeling like, oh, I'm like a fat woman, I'm overweight, but there's so much more going on. Stress is a big factor as well, and genetics. And then there's other conditions and it affects women, where they'll put weight on and it's a different kind of fat tissue. So it's not one that can be lost through diet and exercise. It's an autoimmune condition. So again, they're kind of falling into this category. And it's really easy to look at someone and judge them and say, well, you're fat and lazy, just go out for a run and change your diet, but there's so much more going on for that person than just this very basic calories in, calories out mentality. If it were that easy, you know, people would do it, but there's multiple factors going on. And you don't get to know what those factors are until you sit down with someone and you have that one-to-one conversation. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, oh, there is an autoimmune component in your family, and it's been passed down, and then this person's health is kind of displaying
what that.
So yeah, I think it comes back to this context thing again, isn't
it? But I think that's when you get older, and I can understand that. Mm-hmm. But like, I suppose autoimmune issues are issues, you know, and they definitely have their place. But when you look at, let's go to America. I don't know what the, Annabelle, would you be able to look up what percentage of the American population are overweight?
Oh, it's frighteningly high. I don't know the number.
And it changes daily. That's why I'm just double checking. But I'm pretty sure that, let's say 60% are overweight, something like that. I'm pretty sure maybe 1% of them do have these issues, you know, and that's very, very, mm-hmm. You know, you can't say anything to that.
Nearly one in three adults.
So 1 in 3 adults in America are overweight. So let's say that 10% of those 1 in 3 adults do have these issues.
Which is possible, yeah.
Which is plausible and possible. Mm-hmm. The 90% that are young, that are in their 18 or even younger than that, 16 to mid 30s, that are overweight. That's the category that I just categorically do not agree that they should be not looking themselves in a positive light, but they can't think that it's healthy to be that way.
There's metabolic damage there for sure.
And it's not just metabolic. I mean, the heart attack risk goes up, the cardiac arrest.
That's all part of it, The rates of depression, anxiety, self-harm, suicide, it's all linked to metabolic damage, you know.
That's interesting. So metabolic damage through diet can lead to depressions, anxieties, and...
Yeah, there's a link, yeah.
And that's just purely because of the dopamine levels? Or
There's one element is dopamine, but your microbiome in your gut is where you make your immune system, but it's also where you make your serotonin. So you need serotonin.
I didn't know that.
So and then I worked with someone who went to her doctor, and she said that to her doctor, and her doctor said exactly the same thing. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Just frightening. But yeah, you need serotonin for your mood, to feel contented, to feel buoyant, to feel like sort of safe in your life. So if your diet is devoid of any nutrients, and then you're consuming anti-nutrients, so ultra processed foods take your body longer to break down, so it takes nutrients away. So if you're already depleted, you're then depleting yourself even further. So to kind of think through a stereotype, you're an 18-year-old kid, you're into gaming, and you live in your parents' basement, so you're not getting any vitamin D. You're in darkness constantly. You probably don't sleep very well because you're gaming all the time. Your diet's terrible. You're rapidly putting weight on. You're then really mucking around with your neurotransmitters. Your gut health will not be good at all because you're not eating a gut-healthy diet.
Yeah,
it then becomes, like we were saying, a self-fulfilling prophecy, and you can see that person, how their health tracks.
Yeah,
they then become one of those statistics of chronic health problems.
Well, what do you think of like substitutes? Like, I'm just thinking of, we spoke about Stephen Bartlett recently. He's obviously got investment in this company called Huel, which is marketed as a healthy alternative. And it's not just Huel, there's lots of them, but Huel, for an example, would you say that that's like, that is healthy, or what would your kind of take on that?
Health is subjective as well. And the way that that's marketed as a meal replacement.
Yeah.
So for me personally, I'm uncomfortable with that because it's given the impression that you can skip your meals and just replace it with
Huel.
So there is a place for that. I do a protein drink, although I'll make it myself. It's not a processed one. I'll do that in the morning before my breakfast because I'm looking for a particular amount of protein. But I'm not skipping meals at the rest of the throughout the day. And I don't know. I think it's this quick fix, silver bullet mentality.
It just doesn't exist.
Everything has its place. And as long as you keep it in that place, but it's dangerous, right? Because we're all busy and we all want a quick fix. So I think it's aimed at the individuals that are, too busy doing other things, and maybe their health is not a priority and they just want something that's quick.
Yeah. And I think, I look at quick fixes like silver bullets. And one of them specifically that came up recently, I can't remember who I was speaking to. I think it was maybe Amy Scott. And we were talking about vaping and we're talking about smoking, how smoking became vaping because it's healthier, even though we don't know even though we don't know the knock-on effects. Yeah. And then vaping has now quickly become snussing. So like putting something in your gums and then it releases nicotine.
Right.
So I was with Amy and we were discussing this. And then I was with a friend after or slightly before. Mm. And I turned the snus packet over and I looked at it and it said, if swallowed, see a poison specialist. It says that on the back of the packet. And I was like, fair enough, you're getting your nicotine hit. You're maybe not damaging your lungs as much. But like it's saying to you, it's poison.
Yeah.
So like, I think that a lot of it does come down to like, just don't trust social media. Do your own your own research.
Not that long ago that doctors were promoting smoking. You saw that, you would have seen the adverts from 50s and 60s where it was like, oh, your doctor smokes Camel cigarettes.
Yeah.
And they were part of the advertising campaign. And now we're horrified by that.
Yeah.
So what are we going to think about vaping when enough years have elapsed and we've got more studies?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not good at all.
It's frightening.
There's a lady that works with Chisholm Hunter, who are the sponsors of the podcast, but she used to work for Marlboro.
Mm-hmm.
And she said she used to go into the boardroom at Marlboro and they would give everyone free packs of cigarettes. Mm. And the three board members that were with them wouldn't touch it.
Yeah.
And it's like, everything is a business and you need to understand that I believe that people will cut corners, the accountants will step in and they'll know the risk. Like the company will know the risk of what they're doing, but they'll kind of measure that and measure that up with profits and then be able to pay themselves out of it. It's difficult. I think genetic definitely comes into it a lot as well. I was going to ask you regarding my genetics.
Mm.
So Annabelle will kind of, back me up here. I can eat shit. I can eat utter garbage. I can't put on weight. I just can't put on weight. Now, normally my diet is quite good.
Yeah.
Typically it is quite good. I eat like lots of broccoli, lots of veg and chicken and protein. But just from when I've been a very young age, I've just been able to eat crap and never put on weight.
Yeah, it's probably your metabolism.
So is that just genetic? Is that purely genetics?
It can be. Mm. You're younger too, so your metabolism will be faster. So as you age, your metabolism slows down, but it doesn't need to. I mean, that's just what we believe in the aging process. But there are people in their 70s and 80s that are packing muscle on and they're not frail. So it's a mindset thing as well. But a lot of that will probably be because you're a fast detoxifier. So your body, your liver is detoxifying very, very quickly. What I would say is that's a double-edged sword. That's not necessarily a good thing because it means you're churning through
crap
what you're eating. So when you are eating nutrient dense foods, you want those nutrients to hang around, but if your liver's working like the clappers and it's working really fast, it'll remove them too quick. So it means you're probably not absorbing them, or possibly, I mean, I don't know without running your genetic test, but fast metabolism would be a bit of it, and that is genetics too.
Mm-hmm.
If your parents are similar build, similar stature, then you could say, it's probably genetics.
Yeah.
I think
I'm probably quite similar to my grandpa. Like he was skinny as anything up until he was 70 or 18, up until he died. Mm-hmm. And he was just like a very thin, fit guy. Like, I go to the gym quite a lot. I eat relatively healthy.
Yeah.
I binge every now and again, like this weekend when I was my birthday. But like, I've just never been able to, like, even when I try and I eat more, I've just never been able to put on weight. What percentage of it comes down to like genetics versus diet?
It would be hard because each person's different. And that's the thing, our genetics, we're all 99% genetically the same, but there's this 1% variance. It depends. We each get a unique code that's installed in us, I guess, if you explain it that way. So one set of instructions from your biological father and one set of instructions from your biological mother, that then forms a unique code within you, which is unique. It's hardwired. You can't change it. You've got your genes for life. But what you can do is affect them. So like we were talking earlier, you can dial them up, you can dial them down. So it's like if you've got a sports car, like a Porsche, and you take it into the garage, they'll plug it into the diagnostics and they'll fine tune it. That's what we can do with genetics. So we'll look at the, we're looking at the most common genes. So we're not looking at rare genes that cause cancers or disabilities and things. We're looking at the most common ones that affect sort of mental health, digestion, detoxification. And we can see in someone's genetic pathway, are they lacking something? So vitamin D is an example. So vitamin D is needed as a cofactor in a lot of genetic processes. So if someone is, they live in the Northern Hemisphere, they don't have access to the sun fully and they don't supplement and their diet's terrible, well, we need to look at what's their vitamin D doing. Some people, they have a genetic mutation on their vitamin D, which means even though they're supplementing, that vitamin D is not getting to where it needs to go. So then you start to see that that then has a knock-on effect. So if you need vitamin D for pretty much every system, every process in your body, and you're not getting it, then that it has a knock-on effect. So I don't know percentage-wise, but it's got to be up there. It's got to be a high percentage impact on your health.
What would be the genetic factors that you looked at? Would it be like, would it be how you reuptake kind of vitamins, or what would be the ones that you specifically?
So there's one, it's a nutrient core report, it's called. So it's looking at all the nutrients, all through the spectrum of nutrients. And it's looking at where you have you might have a genetic mutation, it's called. So it's where that sort of process is either it's too fast, so it's churning through too quickly, or it's too slow. So through that, I can sort of fine tune. So like an example of this is vitamin A. So if someone is plant-based or vegan, they will believe, and rightly believe, that they're getting vitamin A from their plants. So they'll get beta-carotene from their sweet potatoes, carrots. But your body needs to do a conversion that converts that into retinol, which is the active form of vitamin A. You are not getting retinol if you're eating plants, because retinol is an animal-based nutrient. You'll only get it if you're eating animal-based protein. So that leaves a whole section of society really vulnerable. They think they're ticking that box, but there's extra steps that the body needs to go through, and they're not getting that conversion.
So if they don't have the genome or the genetic factor, could they not, they'll be malnourished?
They will be as they come into that consultation. Right. So what the options for them at that point is, they can supplement the active form. So you can supplement retinol, or some individuals, if they're plant-based, they might feel okay about adding some fish into their diet or some eggs. Even if they're vegan, depends on their reasons, they might realize that actually my health feels so compromised, I now understand why. They're now willing to put maybe some animal protein into their diet. So signs of that are night blindness. So if you're driving along at night and you're really struggling to see, that's a sign, because it affects vision. You need vitamin A for vision.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So again, it comes back to...
So you just go totally... Do you lose your sight, or like how...
Well, it's night blindness. So it's like your eyes... So if you go into a dark room, your eyes should adjust eventually. You should be able to pick out...
Yeah, and that's why your retina expands.
But if you don't have retinol, your eyes will struggle to do that. So you'll have night blindness. So you'll just walk into that room, it'll be pitch black. You won't be able to see.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, and people don't know that. And they think they're ticking the box, because they're like, oh, this blog told me that, you know, I'm vegan or plant-based. I need to get vitamin A. Vitamin A is in these plant foods. I've done my job. And then someone like me comes along and they're like, well, hang on, there's more to this story.
Yeah.
Again, it comes back to context.
Yeah. What's your, this is a funny position, or a maybe
contentious.
Contentious. Yeah. Contentious is maybe the word. Vegan diets. What are your thoughts?
Well, from a nutrition perspective.
Yeah.
Well, it can leave someone vulnerable.
Yeah.
But I work with people who are vegan, and I'm not in the position to say you should or shouldn't. I mean, my position is to just relay the facts. If someone has gone through so I'll do blood testing as well, so functional blood testing and genetics, and the black and white facts say that individual is undernourished, then we have a conversation about how do we correct that.
Yeah.
That might look like, as I say, it might look like can you put some animal foods in? But that might be a non-starter for someone. So we look at supplements.
Do you not think, like, we talk about social media and social contagions, really, like ADHD epidemic, that's probably more of a social contagion. Yeah. Do you think that veganism is more of a social contagion? Because I think that fundamentally, like, again, this is my views and I've been crucified for it before, but common sense would tell me that when we were cavemen, we wouldn't be vegan.
Yeah. There's that. And then you've got the strong ethical side of it, which I do struggle with too. If I overthink it too much, I get it. I can see it. And it really depends where that person is.
Mentally.
It's an ethical decision. And they'll know themselves. But then as I say, it's a conversation around, well, how do we support you nutritionally then?
Yeah.
If ethically that is a non-starter, then that's fine. It's not about me saying that that's right or wrong, but what can we do?
Yeah.
But heavy supplementation is required, and that, you know, that is what you're saying. We shouldn't need to supplement.
Exactly. And then when it comes to supplements, as we've discussed with, like, Huel is your, you know, whatever it is, or normally these supplements have accountants looking at them saying, we'll make it a bit sweeter because that'll be more addictive. And you know, you've got coconut milk, make it do this and make it this. Like, I feel like people are overcomplicating something that's actually very simple. Don't eat pish. Drink lots of water. Like, do you know what I mean? I think that people overcomplicate things, and it's not that complicated. To an extent.
It depends where you're coming from, doesn't it?
And
like we said, common sense is not so common. And not even necessarily with veganism, but if you live a fast-paced life and you're very, very busy, and you might be maybe an entrepreneur and you're focused on building your empire and your business, but your health is not really top priority, that it's easy for that to backslide to the bottom of the pile and you're just surviving on junk food. But I will tend to see people who've gone through that.
Yeah.
They've survived on the junk food, and then as they've got older, they've realized that they can't get away with what they used to do when they were younger. Their sleep's terrible. They're addicted to things that they don't want to be addicted to. And they sort of come to me in a sort of burnt out
state.
Broken state.
Yeah.
Where, you know, there's lots of things that need unwound.
Yes.
And there's a lot of healing, a lot of gut healing that needs to happen.
So can you damage your gut? Like, see if you, and that will affect your serotonin, I'm guessing.
More so than that, yeah. So,
and how would you damage that? Would that just be for crap
so
food?
You can end up with, you've probably heard of leaky gut.
Yes, I have.
So the cells in your GI tract are only one cell thick. And that there's a reason for that, so that your digestive system can absorb the nutrients. But if they're only one cell thick, they're very vulnerable to damage. So leaky gut basically is where your gut becomes like a sieve. So those cells pull apart.
Okay.
And then toxins, pathogens, chemicals, you name it, can get into the bloodstream, and that's what causes inflammation.
Yeah.
So when I work with someone, it's about healing the gut first.
Is that wheat? Like,
it can do if you're susceptible to it, yeah.
Because I was speaking to, again, it was Ali Houston. I think he was the first guy we had in the podcast. Mm-hmm. We've actually had him on twice. And he's talking about wheat, and he's talking about how it can get through your microbiome.
Well, it also, I can never say this word, it passes the blood-brain barrier.
Yeah.
So gluten.
Yeah.
And if you're sensitive to it, it's like a neurotoxin. It eats away at a part of the brain.
And
it
flames stuff.
Yeah, it causes massive inflammation. So a massive inflammatory response, which is where people will see things like, for them, it might manifest as eczema or itchy skin or allergies. Seasonal allergies, or someone else it might. So for me, if I eat too much gluten, I get achy joints, headaches. So it's neurological. There's celiac disease in my family. So my mum and my brother are celiac. So there's a high possibility that I'm genetically predisposed to.
My brother's celiac as well. Yeah. Can you describe exactly what that is?
So celiac disease is where it's an autoimmune condition. So it's not a fad. My mum gets extremely angry about this. She'll go into somewhere and people think it's a dietary choice, and it's not. If she has gluten, it triggers an autoimmune response. And it's where the little villi, so the little hair, like finger structures inside the GI tract, they lie flat. So you need those to stand up because they absorb nutrients. So we talk about damage, that is damage. So right. The gluten has damaged the GI tract and it leaves them vulnerable to malnutrition because they're not able to.
Right.
But it also leaves them vulnerable to secondary autoimmune conditions. So it's quite common to see someone, if they've got celiac disease, they've then got asthma. So they're, you know, it's a compounding effect. Their vitamin D status is probably really low as well because they're not, I mean, across the board nutritionally, they're probably very low.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not a pleasant one. It's very difficult to eat out when you're celiac as well.
What about like, and this is something that I've seen raising, and especially as I've gotten older, I've been like, oh, I've now got heartburn. That was never an issue before. I've got acid reflux. That's never been an issue. What is the... Is that a lawnmower? It shouldn't get picked up on the mics. We should be fine. But what is the issue with acid reflux? Like, what? Why is it increasing? And yeah, also,
so this is an interesting one.
Is it age?
Well, yeah. Well, it's linked to metabolism. So yeah, it can be age. So acid reflux happens because you've not, as it's kind of counterproductive, you've not got enough stomach acid. So popular nutrition culture will tell you that you need to block that acid. So people then take antacids. That then causes a bigger problem because you're suppressing stomach acid. So you need stomach acid to break your food down.
Right. So wait, what's antacid? Is that just anti?
So
is
like
that,
your, is that like a... Can I name drop? Can I say product names?
Yeah, of course.
Like Rennie's, Gaviscon.
Right. Okay. I've used Rennie's. Yeah, okay.
So what's happening is the acid is backwashing up and you're feeling it at the back of your throat or in your esophagus.
Right.
So there's a couple of things that could be happening. So you could be low stomach acid. So when you eat something, it's pushing that acid up because you don't have enough digestive...
To actually fizzle the food down.
Yeah, so the food's actually sitting higher in your stomach. So it's pushing... There's a valve that sits at the top of your stomach that should close it off after you eat.
Right.
But if you don't have enough stomach acid, the food isn't getting digested. So the food hangs around longer.
Okay.
And it pushes on that valve, which pushes the acid back up. So you think you've got heartburn, acid reflux. It's basically your food sitting in your stomach.
In a different way.
It's just sitting too high in your stomach. You're not digesting. So then you'll take a Gaviscon, which suppresses your stomach acid. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy because then the more you deplete your stomach acid, the less stomach acid you've got and the more acid reflux you'll have. So there's that. There's also a structural element. So some people, that valve is open all the time because maybe posturally their body's twisted and it's pushing on their stomach.
Is that when you sleep on one side? I remember
you sleep on your left.
Yeah, my pal said that. Yeah. He said if you've got heartburn, sleep on your left.
Yeah, because your stomach's slightly off to the left, I think it is.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a low stomach acid thing. Right. And all the adverts tell you it's an acid problem. Well, it is, but again, the context is it's because you've not got enough stomach acid, and that's probably because maybe the diet's highly processed and it's causing you to deplete your acid. But my biggest bugbear is seeing clients get put on omeprazole.
What is that? So is that just a really strong...
A proton pump inhibitor, so a PPI. So it looks like a little Smartie. It's a little purple thing, and they take it because they've got acid reflux.
Yeah.
And if you look at the packaging, you're only meant to be on it like 10 days max. I've met people who've been on it for decades.
Oh no.
Now if you deplete your stomach acid, you're vulnerable because you need acid to fight off pathogens, you need it to break down your food, you need it to absorb your nutrients.
I'm guessing bacteria as well. Yes. Like if you were to eat. Yeah.
And then it sets off a perfect storm of major gut issues and
I never knew that acid reflux.
It's a low acid problem.
Was a low acid problem. Yeah. I always would consider, because acid's coming back up, so surely the acid must be...
There's a reason why it's coming back up. Yeah.
That is mental to me.
And then some people have GERD, which is, I can never say the word, but that's where when they lie down, so they might not have reflux during the day, but when they go to bed at night, because they're lying on their side, it's backwashing back up and they'll feel it in their esophagus.
Yeah. So how would you, I suppose, because when I had acid reflux, it was always after I would eat a sugo. Have you ever been to sugo in Glasgow?
No, no, no.
Oh, it's really
What
good.
Is this?
It's this, just this brilliant pasta place.
Oh, it's pasta, so, right. So okay, good. This makes sense.
Oh, fresh pasta. And it's like, I overdo it 100%.
Yeah.
And basically, I remember so vividly, I'd been out that weekend. Mm-hmm. I'd had a load of crap pizza. And then I think we were in the office and we went out for a sugo, so it was pasta.
Yeah.
And then I remember after it being like, oh, I've got this acid reflux.
Yeah, it'll really heavy. Yeah.
Exactly. Especially fresh pasta. It's like more firm.
Yeah.
So I started taking Rennie's and Gaviscon,
mm-hmm.
and I eventually just had to cut out essentially carbs,
mm-hmm.
bread and pasta mostly. And then I stopped taking the Rennie's and then the heartburn went away. Right. And now I can eat pasta and be fine.
Right.
But do you think it was because I was taking the Rennie's that it wouldn't cure?
Yeah, because that's depleting your stomach acid even more. Yeah.
Wow.
It's an antacid. It's I can't remember the constituents of it, but it's like an alkaline substance. So it alkaline neutralizes anything that's acidic, so it's neutralizing your stomach acid. So to answer the question I think you were going to ask is what could you do instead of that, I would give a client a digestive enzyme. So I take a digestive enzyme, and it's just these little things that help break down your proteins. So you take a capsule just shortly before you eat and it goes into your GI tract, and then that helps break your food down. Things like apple cider vinegar, if you take a tablespoon of that and some warm water before you eat, that helps it supports your liver, which then supports your digestive system. It's simple when you know how.
Exactly. But also, I know we were talking about doctors earlier. It was a doctor that's one of my best pals that was like, you need to start taking Gaviscon. And...
Well, they survived on that, right? Because when they went through medical school, that was nothing about health. But getting through medical school, probably, I know a few doctors where it seriously wrecked their health.
Yeah.
Cramming all hours, eating whatever, stressed. Stress causes acid reflux.
Yeah.
They will have survived on that, and then that becomes a coping mechanism, because then they get to a place where they can't eat without a bottle of Gaviscon somewhere.
Yeah, and they need it.
But
if you were to stop, do you think it's healthier to let your body essentially get the acid levels back naturally rather than taking the Gaviscon?
They need support. So you can use the Gaviscon as a kind of intermediary kind of crutch. I've met clients who have said, if they don't do it, they're literally breathing fire. The pain that they will get, I mean, I've never experienced that.
Yeah.
So you're sort of using it therapeutically. You're using it as a crutch as you're changing your diet, as you're working on your stress, your sleep, because all of those factors affect your stomach acid. So ultimately, you want to increase your stomach acid and do all those things so you can slowly then just, you don't need it, you can put it to the side. I've worked with people who've done that.
Yeah.
I can't tell a client to come off of medication, but we've put support in where they've then not needed the omeprazole.
Yeah.
So they've then gone back to the doctor and said, I don't need that.
And do you suggest, like, do you say to your client?
I can't tell them that. I can strongly hint, but tell them to come off of it. There's another way we could do this.
Yeah.
So you put the support in, and then eventually that crutch, they'll not need it. They can just drop it away.
Isn't it terrible that especially... it's so nice and quiet now, isn't it?
Yeah.
I just realized that. isn't it incredible, or not incredible, isn't it really scary that within the NHS they have this massive pill pushing culture?
Well, it's a pill for an ill, yeah.
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 It's really quite bizarre. I think we had a guest on the other day that we used to work for the NHS, and she's now gone private. And she was saying that when she was in the NHS, that they would say to her, listen, you've got 5 minutes, just give them pills.
Yes.
Like, oh, I'm really, okay, here's pills.
Yeah.
I'm feeling like I've got acid reflux, here's some pills.
It's a flow chart. So you've tried drug A, and that didn't work. Let's go down the flow chart, drug B, and you'll get caught in that. And talk about a profession with burnout. The rates of burnout within medics and doctors is off the charts because they're so pressured. They're probably not able to help in the way that they thought they could,
or they wanted to, or they want to.
It's now all about meeting a metric, and we're completely missing the point. We're maybe meeting metrics, so waiting times are maybe coming down, appointment times are coming down, but it's failing the people, the patients, and the people who work in it are burning out. That doesn't feel like a sustainable model to me.
No,
and it's not helping.
No,
things are getting worse.
Yeah.
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 And it comes back to that context thing and education.
I feel like it's just trying to give people the right education, because doctors aren't taught about diet.
Not unless they've done further education.
Yeah. You
know, they're not equipped to talk about it.
Mm.
And they don't have the time to... I mean, the average consultation for me is 90 minutes. So like an hour and a half. And I'll take longer if I need it, if the client's got the time to really, really get into the nuts and bolts of what's led them to me in the first place and where are we going. And a large part of what I do with clients is built around coaching as well. So it's, I can tell somebody what to do, but as soon as they leave that consultation, I know that their life is just going to swamp them.
Yeah.
So how do they make those small changes meaningful? So
and sustainable.
So I use habit stacking, you know, like the tiny habits thing. So put your supplements, for example, beside your bed. So the ones that you want to take, that I would recommend that you take before you go to bed, put them right beside your bedside table so that you see them. Put your herbal teas right next to your kettle so that you reach for that and you're not reaching for the caffeine, if that's part of your protocol, if you're trying to reduce caffeine. So you're bolting a new habit onto something that you already do.
Yeah.
And I work in tiny, tiny steps.
Mm.
Because what will happen psychologically is, for argument's sake, we'll talk about hydration. So can you drink a liter of water a day? Ultimately, I want them to get to 2-2.5 liters, but they're drinking no water. So let's start with a liter, and that's easy. They'll do it.
Mm.
And then the brain will say, well, what else can we do? And then they just keep adding on, and that creates that stable foundation that we were talking about. You'll never not do that then. You'll never deviate from that. You'll remember, oh, this thing's easy.
Do you get clients that drink little water?
Yeah.
Just is that, but surely that, like, when I don't drink water, I feel a physical difference. And I just feel crap.
Or people who think they're drinking water.
Drink my water. Actually,
perfectly timed. So they'll drink buckets of coffee and tea.
Mm.
There's water in it, but it dehydrates you. So it's
does tea dehydrate you?
Yeah. So the
does
whole
it?
Process of the effect of caffeine dehydrates your body. Yeah. Herbal tea doesn't.
So that, like mint tea wouldn't?
Yeah, so that contributes to your fluid intake.
Okay.
So some people don't like drinking just, you know, straight water if they think it's boring, but you can add them back to the lemon water thing.
Yeah.
That's probably where that came from. You can add lemon, ginger, whatever, have your herbal teas. Mm. Yeah. But yeah, I've met people who are like shriveled.
Just don't.
Dried out raisins.
They just don't drink. I just...
Yeah.
Because you do, but it is quite easy to fall into that. Especially, I think office work is really bad for it.
Yeah.
Because like when I'm in the office, I'll have a coffee and then maybe someone will be like, oh, does anyone want coffee? And I'll go, oh, yeah, I'll get another
one.
And you don't feel thirsty because technically you're drinking.
You're drinking, yeah.
And then you walk away and you're like, wow, I've got a huge migraine. And, and you know, I feel really crap. And, you know, it's just, and that's probably just dehydration, really.
Yeah. Well, there's also, if we come back to genetics. So part of the nutrient core report will flag up whether you genetically can break caffeine down. So there's two markers, there's two genes for it.
Right.
I can't drink caffeine at all. It makes me jittery. And even if I have just one, I can't sleep. So it will tell you how easy you break it down. Caffeine's also got a half-life, so it'll stay in your bloodstream. So genetically, I also don't clear it very well.
Yeah.
So it'll hang around longer than the average person.
And your sleep will be screwed because of that.
I can't sleep. I'm just wired.
Yeah.
Whereas my partner, he'll have an espresso right before bed. And I'm like, how could you do that? So some people genetically can metabolize it and break it down. Others like me just can't do it. So,
and I suppose it's figuring out what's right for you.
Like, most people know as well. They know that they can't drink caffeine because it makes them jittery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like for me, I've got a pal called Andrews that's the same. He'll be like, yeah, let's get a coffee before bed. And I'm like, you're actually nuts. Like, you're 27, grow up. Yeah. So for me, I'll drink coffee up until 12, and 12 is my cutoff.
That's what I would say to a client. Yeah.
If you're and then I know caffeine, I can sleep.
Yeah. Or then switch to decaf. But again, it has to be a good quality decaf, because the process of removing the caffeine is like a toxic process.
Really?
Yeah, they use toxins and chemicals
to
strip the caffeine out.
Annabelle, could you look this up quickly? See, because I remember showing my dad this,
yeah,
because he was like, oh, I always drink decaf because it's healthier. It's healthier.
No.
And I remember, I was a member in Switzerland and I was like, but how do they actually make decaffeinated?
No, it's caffeinated and then they remove the caffeine.
What's the chemical in it?
It's I can't remember. Is it adenosine or?
Steamed membranes repeatedly with the chemical solvent.
It's a solvent.
So they use a chemical solvent to steam it repeatedly.
To take it out.
To take out the caffeine. So actually caffeinated drinks or decaffeinated drinks.
Were once caffeinated. And there's still an element of caffeine in them because they can't remove it 100%. So where I live, we've got a really nice, a place where they, roastery, that's the word I was looking for, where they roast their own beans.
I love the smell in those kind of places. Yeah. It's so nice.
And they have a decaf bean that's been done through a different process. So it's like an anaerobic process. So they use sugar. Okay. To remove the caffeine, and it's the nicest decaf. So I've had decaf coffee and maybe another coffee shop, instant headache because it's the toxins in it, chemicals.
Yeah.
But this one, completely fine, and it tastes like coffee. Amazing. So again, it's knowing enough to know where to look.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose if you weren't to look behind the lines and you were just to say, well, caffeinated coffee, decaf coffee, I want to sleep, I'll go for the decaf.
You wouldn't know any difference.
You wouldn't say, well, the decaf actually has a chemical solvent that's been rinsed through it repeatedly to get rid of the caffeine.
No, like, you wouldn't know that, would you?
Yeah, it's wild. I was going to ask you about, I know you were in Canada recently.
Mm.
The diet in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
What were your first, because I've been as well, what were your first impressions and thoughts?
Well, it's similar to this proximity to the States. It's very similar. So
yeah.
If you're out and about, it's very, very difficult to eat.
Clean.
Healthy. Clean, yeah, that's probably the best word. It's fast food, easy, accessible food. I know what I'm doing and I found it really, as I said to you earlier, I took a hit. I had to take a hit because we were traveling around a lot. So I'll always try and mitigate that by making my own food if I can. I was out of my own environment. We were staying with friends, so I didn't have access to a kitchen to do that. So I knew I was taking a hit. But yeah. It's hard.
Was it bad? Like I remember it
being
all
franchises and fast food chains.
Frankie and Benny's or Dunkin' Donuts,
Chick-fil-A, and
yeah,
Subway, all of them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And as I say, I don't eat gluten. I can tolerate a little bit, but I had to take a gluten hit because I knew I could fix it when I came home.
And how did you fix it? Because that was quite interesting when you described this earlier.
Fix it. That's quite a wild claim, but
got over it. The gluten.
Yes.
Hit.
Mm. So it. It manifests for me as bloating, fatigue, headaches. Okay. So first things first, just come off of it. I just cut all gluten out. I don't normally eat it. Put a probiotic into my supplement schedule. Loads of water, loads of digestive support. So the apple cider vinegar, the digestive enzymes. So lots of gut healing because I knew that gluten will have really wreaked havoc.
On the gut.
In my guts. So yeah, lots of healing, but just abstaining, that's the quickest way, just come off of it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember being in Annabelle and I were in Indonesia, and I've also been to kind of like Southeast Asia, kind of Thailand and all that kind of stuff, and there's not one overweight person.
Interesting.
Legitimately, I think maybe we saw, I could count in one hand the amount of overweight people we saw. And most of them were tourists.
Yeah.
And their diet, I remember being in Indonesia and the diet was like fresh fruit and you know, fresh steamed vegetables and fresh, and it was tasty as hell and super, super healthy. Do you think there's anything that we could take from other cultures, other countries and implement it?
Were there many fast food places?
None.
See, there's your correlation.
And by the way, so my girlfriend and I went to Sri Lanka last year. And I remember we were driving down this, Sri Lanka is a very poor country. It's like Indian is quite poor. Driving through, we had this really brilliant driver who was talking to us and said, I've got a really, really good food recommendation. We need to go there. I was like, okay, let's go. We pulled into this hut. Like, I kid you not, the roof was like falling in.
Shanty.
There was nobody there. It was a family restaurant. The family were sitting there all just smoking cigarettes. And I was like, this is food poisoning. I was like, this is food poisoning. We're going down. Best curry I've ever had. And it was like cheap, as I think it was like 50p for like three of us.
Mm-hmm.
And it was brilliant. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that the government could do or the UK or Americans that could like try and change the tide a little bit?
I don't think it's a government thing.
Do you think it's a business thing?
I think it's an individual thing. I think it's a civic responsibility to make different choices. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy because these businesses exist because people want, but then you're asking yourself, are they're consuming it because they're addicted to it? And the whole model is geared to addiction. There's a Five Guys opened near where I live, and it's just literally opened. And it's just full, rammed full. It's queued out the door because it's new and it's shiny new. But it's like, it's so appealing.
Yeah.
It's kind of got this cult following and whatever, a certain age group and demographic that are there. And it's right there, and it's right next to Nando's. There's a McDonald's round the corner. There's a Tim Hortons, which is a Canadian franchise.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You've got the pick of all of them. And so if your taste buds are used to that, you're just wired for seeking that. So, yeah.
Right. What is your opinion on the carnivore diet?
Okay. This is what every nutritional therapist will say. It depends. And again, it's context. I haven't personally tried it. Although I have followed the sort of feedback of other people who've done it, and they've done it for particular reasons. So there's prominent personalities in social media who've done it for specific reasons. Maybe they've got an autoimmune condition or whatever. And they are espousing the massive benefits that they've had from it. I am not sure from a nutrition standpoint if there's enough of long-term studies to show, are you missing out on any nutrients from not eating any plant foods or vegetables? Yeah. I don't know. The kind of jury's out for me. I'm unsure. And I can't really give a balanced answer because I've not tried it. It doesn't fit with my physiology. But I know people who have done it.
Because it's the influence. As we discussed before, it's like that sphere of influence with Jordan Peterson.
And he's daughter Michaela Peterson, she did it because she had, or still has, serious autoimmune condition that was affecting her joints, and she was in massive pain.
Yeah,
and she's talking about how following the carnivore diet has reduced, if not eliminated, the pain completely.
Inflammation.
But I would argue that there's something else going on underlying that we'd need investigated. I don't think it would be sensible or is easy to say, oh, it's just because she's now eating meat.
Yeah,
there's got to be something else going on there.
There must be something that she's not taking in now that maybe was triggering.
Yeah, so in some people who are so inflamed, all foods start to inflame them. So grains, for example, can really inflame your joints. It can cause pain, and so there's more. We're coming back to this context thing again.
It's really
difficult to say. To hang your hat on one particular thing, which I never do anyway. I never say this diet is the diet of all diets. It depends on the person.
What about keto?
Same thing.
Same thing.
And it depends why you're doing it. And also, like, it's really hard to maintain.
Yeah.
Socially, you're going to have to become a hermit.
Pasta's too nice. Pasta's too good to like start cutting all that shit out.
For me, it's about being what we call metabolically flexible. So you can maybe do a bit of keto, which probably looks more like low carb, high protein, moderate fat.
And that's probably what everyone should do, especially nowadays.
That's basically what the Mediterranean diet is. If you were to pick an ideal diet or a way of eating, the Mediterranean diet. There's a lot of research. There's enough studies to back it up. But you can flex in and out of it. So if you have a night out and you have a bowl of pasta or whatever, it's not detrimental. You can then revert back to what you were doing before and being able to just flex in and out of that. So you're allowing your brain to run on glucose and then allowing it to run on ketones. So you can switch in and out of it. And there's a lot of research to show that that's actually healthy. That keeps your body metabolically primed to switch in and out of that. Yeah.
I'll send you that podcast after with Ali because that
would be interesting.
It's really interesting. It's also the first podcast I ever did, so that I was so awkward. But the information in it's really, really good. Like in terms of what he was saying, and he he knows all the names of every study that he's like, he's the guy's super smart.
For people who have epilepsy, I mean, that's where it came from. That was what
exactly
it was, the protocol for epilepsy was the ketogenic diet. And I know people who do practice it for that reason, but it does make your life very, very small.
Yes.
But if you're faced with the what feels like the threat of seizures that are very detrimental to someone who has epilepsy, I suppose that's a trade-off, right? You're prepared to, you'll have to do that. But for most of us, we're maybe not willing for our life to be that restricted and that small. And it's about deciding that you can just flex in and out of it. You can take bits of it that work for you and maybe drop the restrictive part of it.
Yeah, yeah. I did have last one, but I've realised we've already covered it, which is veganism. So I think we've already covered that one.
That,
Listen, I think that's our time, but thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Where can people find you if they're looking for you?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram. So it's just gn.wellness on Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn. Just type in my name into LinkedIn. And my website is jennanelson.com, and it's Jenna with a G.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.